Liberation Radio.
Capitalism needs poverty.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
Whatever we could do, we're gonna do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth.
Each week, we bring you interviews, commentary, analysis, political developments, and struggles affecting workers throughout the country as a way to build the movement for socialism in the United States.
The revolution will be broadcast.
The only thing that will ever defeat racism will be the defeat of its parents, capitalism and imperialism.
Without smashing mass incarceration, working people of all nationalities cannot have justice.
Liberation Radio is brought to you by the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
Welcome to Liberation Radio, a podcast of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. I'm your host, Marcel Cartier. This week we go inside the Women's Liberation Movement and talk to Megan Adams of Women Organized to Resist and Defend, or WORD. And we talk to Mazda Majidi, a member of the PSL on the West Coast, about the recent Iran nuclear deal and the ending of sanctions against Iran. What's next in U.S.-Iran relations?
And here on Liberation Radio, we are joined by Megan Adams from Women Organized to Resist and Defend, WORD, in San Francisco to discuss a whole range of issues facing women coming up in the early part of this year and really leaking over from last year when the issue of women's oppression has really become acute again. So, Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on here.
So what I wanted to start with is on March 2nd, ironically enough, the second day of Women's History Month, the Supreme Court is going to be hearing a case on a range, an omnibus laws in Texas, House Bill 2, I believe the case is Whole Women's Health v. Cole. And that seems like that'll be a big focus point for a lot of what's been happening in the past few months that I want to talk about. But I was wondering if to start you could just say a little bit about what's at stake in this Supreme Court case. What exactly is going on and what are the implications?
So I think that this is, it's a really big case. This was the bill that was being passed, if people remember, back in 2013. It was really, really big and kind of was getting a lot of national notoriety because this was the bill, the omnibus bill that was going through the Texas legislature that Wendy Davis filibustered for hours to hit it past the midnight mark. There were multiple days in which hundreds of Texans flooded the Capitol building, all the state rig to make that stand of, no, we don't want these restrictions on it. Through sneaky political maneuvers, it did end up passing. And the result is that, Texas is a huge state and had at that time before the bill, there were 40 clinics in the state of Texas that provided abortions for women there. After this passed and when the first components of it got implemented, it closed half of those clinics down. And what's going on with this, with the current case that's going up to the Supreme Court is that it's about hearing the last two components that haven't been implemented yet and that were supposed to go into effect last June, I believe. One of them is the requirement of doctors to have admitting privileges to a hospital within 30 miles of where they practice. And the other one is that these clinics need to upgrade in order to become ambulatory surgical centers, turning them essentially into hospitals. And that if this happens, those are such great burdens for the clinics to be able to do, it'll close another half of it and will leave only 9 or 10 abortion clinics left for the entire state of Texas with millions of people in it. And it's something like that there will be no clinics open west of San Antonio and the whole Rio Grande Valley region in the south will only have one. And so it's a huge amount of women that won't have any access.
Wow. And that's, And it's interesting, and this is maybe a little bit of a side point, but before we go on more, I think it's important to stress, and correct me if I'm wrong, that and not only is it restricting access to abortion, but I mean a whole range of health services that are provided to women at a lot of these clinics essentially are just, it's just going to disappear, correct?
Yes. I mean, because, I mean, it was the same thing we went through talking about this last fall when there's, you know, there was that whole hysteria whipped up over the, like, the disgustingly edited videos that were targeting Planned Parenthood, is that these clinics do a lot of preventative care. It's a lot of contraception. Like, the biggest thing is that, like, for poor and working women, usually a lot of these, like, local health clinics are the only access to health care that they actually have. And to close, like, huge numbers of these down really leaves lots of women, I mean, this will be immediately Texas, but, you know, there's huge expectations it's going to impact all of the laws that are, like, all the conservatives that are trying to do impose these anti-abortion laws, that it'll affect women there, too, in their ability to get cancer screenings or STI treatments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think that the fact that you brought up the Planned Parenthood video is, you know, a good segue into my next question. And, you know, it's interesting to see the law in North Carolina now that's coming around where doctors have to, you know, send the picture of the ultrasound to these bureaucrats in the state government. And the way they're justifying it is this video with Planned Parenthood. They're saying, oh, well, this shows that, in their words now, these people, quote unquote, these people can't be trusted. And so, I mean, maybe you could say a little bit more, too, about that video. And I mean, because, you know, apparently it shows one thing according to the right wing, but according to Planned Parenthood, it doesn't save others. But, yeah, so maybe that's a good place to start. Maybe debunk some of that video a little bit.
Yeah, because I know that it was, so the video was edited by the Center for Medical Progress, is the one who put it out. I know they've also had to admit, and because I know they've been going to court because Planned Parenthood has been, took them to court and is suing them for getting the full access to it. And they've had to admit that they were intentionally deceiving people. I forget the exact words that they ended up using, but they've admitted that they intentionally censored it. And one of the things that was also noteworthy is the fact that previous videos that have been produced to target Planned Parenthood, whether it was like talking about, like, you know, informed consent or sex trafficking, that there was a group called Live Action that is now completely, like, recognized as just being this really reactionary group that spins lies, is that several of the members from Live Action are those who are now involved in the Center for Medical Progress. Yeah, so it's kind of, I don't know, it's, I mean, it's completely, it, I don't know.
No, I hear you. The viewpoint that's given about what happened, which is like these people are out here like chopping up babies and selling the limbs and the organs, is clearly not what was really happening there.
Yeah, I mean, and they have all sorts of, they have all sorts of things that show, like, oh, some of the images that are shown are not actually taken from that, like, are not of that age or of a particular thing, but they claim it to be, even though it's not in reality.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you know, when we were chatting a little bit prior to the interview, we were talking about the North Carolina law, and you were mentioning how it becomes hard to even keep track of some of these laws because there's so many, you know, passing, restricting abortion rights and access to women's health all across the country. I just didn't know if there were other things. I mean, Texas is big and people are hearing about North Carolina. Were there other things you thought people really should be either keeping an eye on or know about in this regard?
I mean, like, I think it's interesting going through of kind of, I mean, that's why it's so overwhelming, is because there's so many states. Because I think what the Guttmacher Institute was publishing some of the statistics since yesterday was the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. So January 22nd was the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, and they were putting out some of the details. So in the last 5 years, there's been 288 abortion restrictions that have been done since November 2010. And majority of these have happened in about 15 states. Some of them, like, I think forget which one it is, but has had 30 new restrictions in the last couple of years. And so there's a lot of super targeting that's happening. It's all sorts of things. Like, I almost feel like it's hard to keep track of which ones are putting new ultrasound bills in, or the fetal pain, or the heartbeat protection.
This is Liberation Radio. The PSL is a different kind of political party. We are not a party of career politicians, but a working class party of activists and organizers, fighting for a system where the wealth of society belongs not to a tiny, privileged elite of multi-billionaires, but the workers who produce it. Visit pslweb.org to learn more about the PSL, find a branch near you, and learn how you can become a member. Again, that's pslweb.org, pslweb.org.
But that, with all of that violence that they display at the international level, when you and I want just a little bit of freedom, we're supposed to be non-violent. They're violent. They're violent in Korea. They're violent in Germany. They're violent in the South Pacific. They're violent in Cuba. They're violent wherever they go. But when it comes time for you and me to protect ourselves against lynchers, they tell us to be non-violent.
By Mazda Majidi for an overview of the Iran nuclear deal and an analysis of what the ending of the sanctions against Iran mean, not only for Iran, but for Iran-U.S. relations. What is the significance of the sanctions against Iran being lifted last week, and what effect did the sanctions have on the Iranian government and on the Iranian people?
Well, the sanctions having been lifted is very, very significant at two levels. One is obviously for the Iranian economy and the possibilities for growth and the possibilities for acquire the things that the economy needs. But then the other thing also is the effect of the lifting of the sanctions from the geopolitical perspective. In terms of the Iranian economy, I mean, the sanctions did not turn out to be as crippling as the U.S. and its imperialist allies would have hoped them to be. I mean, when you compare it to the sanctions on Iraq, where every day, literally hundreds of thousands of people were losing their lives due to the sanctions. I'm talking about the sanctions on Iraq in the 90s, after the infrastructure of Iraq had been destroyed. In Iran, the sanctions didn't come anywhere near that level. The economy and the government seemed to do a very good job of managing the sanctions and minimizing the impacts. But it has to be said that what the sanctions were doing, it wasn't just that the U.S. was not trading with Iran. It's that any country, whether U.S. or the Europeans or countries in the region, trading with Iran were subject to severe punishment. So the sanctions had essentially cut down the export of oil to about half or less of what it had been prior to the sanctions. And in order to purchase anything in international trade, Iran had to trade in cash or go through back doors or set up temporary and not real shipping companies, trade companies, and so forth. So there were lots of restrictions that the sanctions were imposing on the Iranian economy. And now, after a long, long process, those sanctions have been lifted, so Iran can openly and legally trade again in the international markets, including the sale of oil and gas.
So what motivation did the Western powers, and particularly the United States, have for implementing sanctions in the first place? I mean, of course, they said it was because of Iran's development of nuclear technology, but what was the real political desire behind the implementation of the sanctions? And what effect did they hope that they would have politically, and what was the motivation for ending them at this time?
Well, in short, the effect that they were hoping for the sanctions was regime change. Basically, since the 1979 Iranian Revolution, the U.S. has always wanted to overthrow the Iranian state. And from the U.S.'s perspective, whether Republican administrations were in power or Democratic administrations were in power, no independent states can be tolerated. What Washington wants, particularly in the Middle East, is compliant states that, you know, take their orders from Washington, that do not support, you know, liberation movements, the Palestinian struggle, that basically toe the line of Washington. And for that reason, while the U.S. has not invaded Iran, they have it has always tried, up until recently, over the Iranian state. So the significance of the sanctions politically from as far as the U.S. policy in the region is concerned, is that it is really the first time since the 1979 revolution that the U.S. government has recognized the fact that the Iranian state is, you know, in place, is not about to be overthrown, it is not on the verge of collapse, and therefore accepting a state in the region that does not take its orders from Washington, accepting a government in a region that is an independent state that often goes against the wishes of Washington, take the examples of Syria or Iraq or Palestine, that's something very significant. Regime change right now is on hold as far as Washington policy is concerned, and so the order of the day is for the U.S. to figure out other ways to weaken the Islamic Republic of Iran, but in the meantime, having to deal with it. And that is very significant. When Washington sets conditions on oppressed countries, when it launches into various campaigns of funding the opposition, propaganda against the state, sanctions, and so forth, usually the end result is supposed to be the overthrow of the state. It is not often that Washington is forced to go back and accept that that state is going to be here to stay.
I mean, that being said, do you think that there's a possibility that there will again be a shift in U.S. policy towards Iran? In other words, a shift back to a more pro-sanctions kind of regimen. And particularly, of course, I'm talking about the Republican establishment that was up in arms about Obama's Iran nuclear deal. And, you know, they still talk about how this is actually making the United States more vulnerable to nuclear attack and things of this sort. And so I wanted to ask you about that, and also about the role of Israel and what Israel's approach is to Iran and vice versa.
Sure. I mean, virtually all the, you know, the Republican candidates are saying the first thing they want to do is tear up the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which is the name of the agreement with Iran, and go back to essentially regime change. I mean, I think it's very significant to see, again, from the perspective of the imperialist establishment, why there is so much opposition to this. I mean, if you look at the map of the Middle East, say in 2000, you would see a bunch of U.S. client states, the likes of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and United Arab Emirates and Egypt and Jordan and all the rest. And then you would see Iraq under the Ba'ath Party at the time, Syria under its Ba'ath Party at the time, Iran, and then Libya in North Africa. These were the independent states in the region. And of course, the U.S. wanted to overthrow all of them. Now, fast forward to 2014, 2015, and even now, of course, the U.S. has, through its invasion and occupation, overthrown the state in Iraq. Through its 2011 intervention, the U.S. and NATO overthrew the independent state in Libya under the leadership of Muammar Gaddafi, and Syria has been in a civil war for 5 years now that has severely weakened it. So again, if you look at the map of the Middle East, the only strong state that stands that the U.S. would very much like to overthrow is the state in Iran. So part of the U.S. establishment says, why are you accepting Iran's existence? Let's continue with sanctions. Let's continue with regime change efforts. Now, the Obama administration and some of the foreign policy realists, of course, have now recognize that Iran's state is not going anywhere, at least in the foreseeable future. And, of course, then there's the issue of ISIS, the fact that the Islamic State is now controlling much of Iraqi territory and much of Syria's territory. And that is another factor that has shifted U.S. policy under the Obama administration, as well as the fact that the U.S. was on the verge of launching a bombing campaign on Syria, which didn't work due to strong opposition, both internationally and the U.S., so it never really took off the ground. So the conditions changed. Now, it is certainly possible that, especially if a Republican administration takes power after the elections in the U.S., that the U.S. would go back towards more of a regime change policy. Having said that, the sanctions that were in place, especially since 2011 up to very recently, are not going to be implemented in the same way. What was particularly debilitating about the sanctions was not just that the U.S. was sanctioning Iran, which effectively has been in place since the revolution, but the fact that internationally, especially with the agreement of other imperialist powers, Iran was frozen out of the international banking system. And to do that, the agreement on cooperation of, you know, Britain, France, Germany, and even Russia and China is required international, in both the UN and other international bodies. And that is not forthcoming this time. So even if the Republican administration takes place, and if they take active steps to bring back the sanctions, they are very likely to be just U.S. sanctions and not international ones, which means that they're going to have a minimal effect on Iran. Having said that, whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, if an opportunity arises where they feel like there's a chance for destabilizing the Iranian state, it doesn't matter which party is in power, we will see the funding of the opposition. We will see the encouragement for various pro-West forces within Iran to make an uprising, much like what we saw in 2009 and the so-called Green Revolution. So, there's nothing permanent, of course. The fact that the Obama administration and some of the foreign policy realists right now recognize that Iran is here to stay for now doesn't mean that they will not change course if they think at some point that regime change becomes a realistic possibility. Now, in terms of Israel, that's an interesting discussion in and of itself, because I think we have to recognize that while in the U.S. a lot of individuals always talk about Israel controlling U.S. foreign policy, that's certainly not true. It has never been true, even at under the most pro-U.S. administrations, pro-Israel administrations in the U.S., U.S. foreign policy is not controlled by Israel. I mean, the Israeli ruling class obviously has different interests than the U.S. ruling class. There are very, very wide areas of agreement and joint interest between the two ruling classes. But when you think of the size of the Israeli ruling class, it is not possible for Israel to control U.S. policy in the Middle East. And when you just look at just the case of Iran, it is very clear that it is not Israel that is calling the shots. I mean, even the Bush 2 administration completely resisted Israel and Netanyahu's pressure for the U.S. to start a war with Iran. And in fact, both under Bush 2 and Obama, they have told Israel in no uncertain terms, don't start anything, don't bomb Iran. Because, of course, the U.S. Establishment realizes that if Israel were to start a bombing or military confrontation with Iran, it is not Israel that will bear the cost, it will be the U.S. But from Israel's perspective, it is best for the U.S. to maintain hostile and warlike relationships with various independent countries. That's where Israel comes in and proves its value, its service that it provides to the U.S. So the U.S. reaching agreements, whether with Iran or Syria or other states, it does not serve the interests of the Israeli ruling class. Because what Israel has said and has done for the U.S. is that I will take care of your interests in the region. I will bomb, I will invade, I will assassinate whoever you want. So when the U.S. reaches some sort of an agreement with Iran, which is certainly now a regional power, that does not bode well for Israel and its worth, its value to the U.S. establishment, which in turn harms its ever-expansionist policies in the Middle East and how it wants to expand further and further the settlements and what it wants to annex to Israel.
Liberation Radio is produced by the Party for Socialism and Liberation. PSL believes the only solution to the crisis of capitalism is the socialist transformation of society. Imperialist war, unemployment and poverty, deteriorating healthcare, housing and education, racism, discrimination and violence based on gender and sexual orientation, environmental destruction, all are inevitable products of the capitalist system itself. For the great majority of people in the world, including tens of millions in the United States, conditions of life and work are worsening. There is no prospect that the situation can or will be turned around if continued in the current direction. The Party for Socialism and Liberation believes there is a better way. As the world is now, big capitalist owners, a tiny fraction of the population, dominate society. PSL believes only when the wealth of society is owned by the many who created it, rather than the few who now hold legal title to it, will it be possible to speak about democracy in a realistic way. PSL welcomes new and veteran activists and organizers from all walks of life. For more information, visit pslweb.org or connect on Twitter or Facebook. /PSLweb, Liberation, PSL's newspaper, is online at liberationnews.org.